Matthias Klum makes a living by shooting photographs of some of the world's most endangered species and places. A shooter for National Geographic, Klum might be considered an endangered species himself, given the video I watched of him the other night shooting close-ups of the venomous Chinese cobra, which can shoot its venom up to nearly 7 feet, and even a single drop of that venom can blind you. But there he sat, shooting away nonetheless. Matthias Klum was in town speaking at the Kauffman Center, and he stopped by our studios. Matthias, welcome.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, can we begin with your decision to shoot close-ups of the Chinese cobra? What on earth were you thinking, and why did you want to shoot the Chinese cobra?
It's actually for an upcoming story for the magazine about some of the most lethal snakes in the world and how we can use the venom for our own benefit, not just show that they are feared creatures, but also they should be revered. So, but in this particular situation, you get really close to snakes in the wild. That's what I do mostly. But in this case, it was a captive situation where...
You were in Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was a snake, basically a guy that was... He was breeding snakes and he wanted to show off one of his Chinese spitting cobras. but he didn't know that I'm used to, working close to snakes. So he sort of pulled the tail of the snake a little bit too much. That sort of infuriated her slightly. So as soon as it got really close to me, all she wanted to do was to bite me, which is not necessarily the ideal situation.
Well, you were very close to this snake. I'm watching the video, and the snake is, of course, reared back in strike position as you shot away. And that snake was within – it could pop and jump on your hand, I think, fairly easily. How difficult is it to shoot under conditions like that?
I think I'm very used to working close to snakes. I don't like working close to animals that are aggravated. I mean, I don't like that. I like what I really, really cherish is the situations where I can read the behavior of the animal or the person in front of me and really with humility approach. But on this specific assignment, this is what happened, and the important part of the picture there was actually the man and the serpent. So that's what I had to deal with. But then you just have to be careful because obviously, as you said, they can spit with great accuracy, and she could also bite me because she was a bit close. So you have to just be very careful.
Yes, very careful. That's a very good thing. I think someone said to you during the shoot, if you had a death wish yourself, and you responded by saying you have a wife and kids back home, and you were very aware of the situation at hand here, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really love to photograph animals. But again, what's sort of a bit risky in this situation is that if you have somebody else sort of holding on to the tail of a lethal snake, And this person is a little bit sort of jumpy uncertain in the way how I can handle the situation. So anyway, this is what happened. But I survived. I'm here in Kansas City.
Well, is there a weird depth perception situation here as you look through the viewfinder at the snake? Sometimes the snake is actually closer than it appears in reality. And that's got to be kind of tricky sometimes too.
Actually, this happened to me when I was doing an assignment some years ago for National Geographic on king cobras. And my assistant, Lars Magnus, and I, we were in India and we were photographing a snake charmer. And he has a sort of la grande finale. He had this king cobra that he brought out of a box. And it's illegal to use king cobras for this in India. But that was part of the story. And all of a sudden, when I was using a wide angle, I was lying on my stomach there in the gravel, and this young king cobra came up to me, and my assistant said, "Matthias, it's very, very close to you right now." And I said to him, I whispered, "Yeah, I know." But then all of a sudden, I could feel my left hand being tickled by the tongue of the king cobra, and then I said, "Okay, oh, I see, it's that close."
And what did you do at that moment, Matthias?
You have to be very still. I mean, if snakes react, especially diurnal snakes like elapids or cobras, they react to basically how you react. So if you would do some kind of a, you know, silly or fast, you know, movement, that could trigger a bite, an attack. So you have to be just very, very stable.
I think that would be a very, very difficult situation for Steve Kraske to be in. I just can't begin to imagine what that was like. And so you relaxed and the cobra eventually went away, or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But this is all, you know, when you work in situations where people are involved, animals tend to get less predictable because there are, you know, there are other sets of rules. But while you work in the wild, it's much safer in a way, I think.
We're visiting with National Geographic photographer Matthias Klum. You know, you've devoted your career to portraying threatened environments, and there's a lot of that obviously going on around the world these days. Give us a report, Matthias, from the front lines here. What are you seeing as you make your travels around the globe these days?
I see that we are obviously 7 billion people on the planet. We're soon to be 8 or even 9 in a few years.
Yeah.
It's sort of a struggle a bit because it's a balancing act. We've come to a crossroads, in my opinion, where we can either go in the same as usual route, which hasn't proved very successful in our relationships if you look at it from a sustainability standpoint, that route is not the best choice. Or we can use new technology, the wisdom that we actually have and our relative intelligence to find smarter ways to deal with how we treat the planet and how we make use of our resources on the planet. So to me, it's actually a good trip ahead, but we do need to change certain things.
Hey, are you seeing certain environments, certain ecosystems that maybe you've been to in the past, you're seeing them again and you're noticing change?
It happens all the time. I mean, since I've done this for more than 20 years, I have been repeatedly I've been coming back to certain regions like the Amazon or Borneo, or could be glaciers in Iceland, and I can, with my own eyes and through my images and films, I can see a very clear, drastic change. But I'm also very much involved in conservation issues through my role as an IUCN Global Goodwill Ambassador, and I'm also working with World Wildlife Fund.
IUCN stands for?
IUCN. It's the International Union for Conservation of Nature. So I tap into the scientific community just to try to add depth to my own work and to my own imagery. Things are changing, and we can't turn away from that. We can't, pretend that this is some kind of a normal fluctuation. I mean, we're losing species, we're losing glaciers, we are eutrophicating the seas, and we just have some really, really powerful issues together with the other ones we already know of, pandemics and water distribution issues, war, famine, etc.
Well, how concerned are you? Because as I talk to my friends, my neighbors, my colleagues here in the middle of America, you hear a lot of people saying, well, global warming, that's not too bad because the winters here are shorter now, and that's okay with me. They don't seem upset. They almost seem pleased with what's going on. You certainly don't sense, a sweeping groundswell in this country to begin to make dramatic change. And I'm wondering, given that, how concerned are you?
Well, I am. I am truly concerned, and I feel that we have to, regardless of platforming life and where we live and lead our lives, we need to make some kind of a personal audit every once in a while where we look at how we lead our lives and what we could do differently and more sustainably, because the fact of the matter is very simple, really, mathematically very simple. If we're 7 billion people and we would make different, smarter, more sustainable choices, that affects huge change. And I mean, the fact that, for example, the glaciers are melting really quickly, that the Ross ice shelf in Antarctica, for example, is now sliding into the sea. This is possibly some of the most horrendous and most expensive changes for our species.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want to sound defeatist because I'm really optimistic because we are the only animal, the only creature, if I may say so, on the planet that can sit in a room and intelligently discuss smart solutions together multidisciplinarily. We can never ask that from a bonobo, a chimpanzee or an orca. So, but we have to be smarter.
I wanted to ask you about some of the critters you have photographed over the years. You photographed meerkats in the Kalahari Desert. Remind us what a meerkat is.
It's a silly-looking, dorky little creature standing on its hind legs in groups up to 10, 15, 20 even, with group leaders or sentinels, babysitters, guards. And they always have a female that is a sort of an alpha female, and they have an alpha male. And the alpha female, in my opinion, is sort of higher up, like in most homes. And she will then basically hand out chores to other family members.
Mm-hmm.
And that they obey in a very sort of rigid way. So you can actually see alpha female and male out hunting for scorpions and eggs and lizards and all sorts of things. And you will have their siblings babysitting their offspring in the most caring way.
Mm.
They will hold them, embrace them, and they're just phenomenal.
And how do you shoot them? What time of day? How do you go about capturing these animals?
They are diurnal. They are up daytime, and nighttime they sleep in burrows or bolt holes in the Kalahari in southern Africa. And what I did was that I tried to habituate them gradually. So I approached the bolt holes and the places where they were sort of closer and closer every day. And eventually I could basically lie down on my stomach next to the burrows. So when they woke up in the morning, I would already be there. And they would come up, they would sun their bellies, and they would just stand there. And they're so sweet because they talk amongst themselves. It's like, oh, how are you this morning? Well, I'm okay. Well, are you hungry? No, I'm not that hungry. I had a bit millipede last night.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're very, very cool creatures.
You've also shot kinkajous in Panama, shy creatures, if I understand right. Describe them to us, because they were more difficult for you to shoot, I think.
They were more difficult, absolutely. They are nocturnal and arboreal, so you'll find them up in the neotropics, up in the rainforest canopy. And I choose to work with them in Panama, and it took me 16 weeks, you feel like some kind of a Swedish buffet, a smorgasbord when you're hanging up there in the canopy 150 feet up. You can't go down. You can't go anywhere. And you have like the combined forces of mosquitoes in Panama having a bite. But then eventually when you actually get to see this raccoon-related badger-sized little furry, cute animal with its prehensile tail coming up towards you and then going for the balsa nectar in the big, big balsa flowers. You know, you can. Then it's worth everything.
What you're saying, so to shoot this animal, a kinkajou, you had to actually construct some sort of treehouse kind of thing to go up and allow yourself to stay up high in the canopy of the trees in Panama.
Well, what I did was I was using a rope, a static climbing rope, and I would get all the way up into the canopy, and then I would sit there from late afternoon all night very carefully. Sometimes we camouflaged ourselves in a blind, and sometimes just sitting openly in a tree fork, basically.
All for a few photographs.
All for a few photographs. But I have to tell you, the thing about why would you send anybody out in 2012 to take pictures of an endangered species when 2 children per minute die from malaria. But that's really because all these creatures become spokespersons, ambassadors for sustainability.
Hmm.
You know, so to me, that's...
So that's the point.
That's the point, really, yeah.
Yeah. You've also photographed Asiatic lions in India. Tell us about the lions.
Sometimes I feel National Geographic wants to get rid of me. It's like, what
thought crossed my mind too, Matthias, that's for sure.
What can we do to get rid of this crazy Swede? But anyway, this was an assignment where, you know, most people think of lions as merely African creatures, but you can find about 300 in Western India, in Gujarat, in a teak forest. These are forest dwellers, genetically separated from their African cousins. And so what I tried to do was to sneak up on them on foot in the forest. And it's something about that that's really spectacular, because all of a sudden you feel like lunch. You know? And it's a good sensation.
Yeah, yeah. How close do you get?
Too close at some point, at some stages. I had a female lioness. She's less than 15 feet away. And, you know, they're big girls. They're, you know, you're a snack to them. So you have to be very, very careful.
Well, how do you handle a situation like that where you're 15 feet away and you're shooting photographs? You're not so busy worrying about self-defense. Or what do you do in a situation like that?
In that particular situation, she approached me. Mm. So I was already there, which makes it better in one way and harder in another way. But then I never wear guns or arm. I mean, I'm never armed. I usually have like a Leatherman tool or something like that, but that wouldn't do much to her. So I use – the only thing I try to use is common sense, and to be like with the snakes we touched on before, be – humble and show humility, but also use previous experiences to evaluate what's going to happen, what could happen.
Well, in the case when the lioness is 15 feet away, what does that translate to? What did you do? Did you continue to shoot, or did you put your camera down and begin to think about escape plan number one and escape plan number five?
About my last will. And
yeah.
Yeah. No, well, actually, what I did was I had to, when she approached me, I had to put my camera down. I had to just be face down in the mud, basically. I didn't want to, you know, send any signals to her. I tried to be just a neutral and low adrenaline, which is very hard when you actually feel that you should have high adrenaline.
You literally put your face down in the mud.
Yeah. I had to be very, very, very sort of non...
Threatening.
Yeah, non-threatening to her. But then when she relaxed, everything changed and I could start shooting again.
How did you know when it was time to pull your head up and begin to shoot again?
Because I could see in her body language what she was doing and how she was reacting to me.
Were you watching her out of one eye?
Yeah, I was like underneath my little cap. I had sort of one eye that I could sort of I could see parts of her, and when I saw that she was doing, she rolled over even, and I could sense that she wasn't stressed by me. She was rather bored or something else, or playful. And then my behavior could change as well.
You slowly got back up and began shooting again.
Yeah, yeah.
Man. Do you get assignments from National Geographic sometimes that you consider just too difficult? Is there such a thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are many assignments. Most assignments are very difficult. And if you if you expect them to be easy, you will lose.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's always really hard to do something justice to 50 million readers or to yourself, for that matter. You really want to... You know, I'm sure you feel the same way when, as a journalist, you want to do your best. You want to do a certain phenomenon justice, and that's hard. It's like reinventing the wheel mm-hmm. every time.
Mm-hmm.
And there constantly I doubt myself at certain stages, and that's when you have the team at National Geographic, but also your assistant saying, "Come on, no, hang in there.
Yeah.
We can do it."
Yeah. What caused you to want to make photography your career?
I just got completely hooked. I just felt
that, as a kid?
Yeah, as a kid. When I was 13, 14 years old, I felt that I borrowed my dad's camera and I just felt that this is so much fun. I can't stop. And they tried to get me to do my homework and do other things, and I basically really couldn't. I had to do it.
Tell me about the day you were hired by National Geographic. What happened?
I got to show pictures in Washington to a picture editor, John Schneeberger, he liked what he saw. He said that, well, you look like somebody's grandson. He said, you're so young, but I mean, you should meet people higher up in the system. So I got to see Susan Smith, and she was a former associate director of photography, and she, for some strange reason, she had this paper in front of her, and she asked me my name, and I said Matthias Klum, and she said M-A-T-T-I-S-K-L-U-M, and how do you pronounce it? And she was very formal. And I said, so what kind of formal education do you have? And how many times have you been published by Newsweek, Time, Life, whatever? And the whole page was empty by the end of it. She had my name and nothing else, because I had really not a background that could impress her. So she looked at my work, and then she just went out the door, and she came back and said, now the directors of photography at National Geographic can see you. And they looked at my work and said, you've got some talent. Would you like to work for us?
Just that simple.
Yeah.
And that moment must have felt
utopical.
Like what? Yeah, yeah. What did that feel like for you?
I remember I couldn't really – I didn't know if I should laugh or cry. I felt really – it was strangest thing. And I was 23 years old, and I had a suit on. And I remember they said to me, you don't look like a photographer. You look like you're selling vacuum cleaners. But I didn't know what to do, you know. Mm-hmm. I just came from Sweden. I'd never figured that out.
Did you just show up there, or were you invited?
I was invited by a writer to just basically – well, I wasn't formally invited by National Geographic, so it was all luck. Mm-hmm. But I had some meetings there, and the one thing led to the other.
Matthias, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks for having me. It was super nice to talk to you.
Matthias Klum is a photographer for National Geographic. He spoke at the Kauffman Center. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.